is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. We've been talking over the last 10 years, I guess, or more, about the consequences of too much corporate power. What happens in a small-d democracy, a democratic republic, let's call it? What happens in a democratic republic when private interests acquire enough power that they can effectively control public interests, in other words, government? What happens? And what do you do about that? Let me just give you a couple of examples, first of all. This from Vox.com this morning. Corporations now spend more lobbying Congress than taxpayers spend funding Congress. The budget for Congress that you and I pay with our tax dollars, the budget for Congress is $2 billion this year. And corporations are going to spend more than, or have, I guess in the last year, spent about $2.6 billion lobbying Congress. I mean, that's astonishing. And you see that as much as 80% of the time that a member of the House or the Senate spends every day is spent begging increasingly richer and richer people for money. Because the richest 1/100 of 1%, right? The richest 1 out of 1,000 Americans gave 42% of political donations in 2012. It's not the 1%. It's not the 0.1%. It's the 0.01%. 42% of political donations. Direct result of Citizens United, by the way. Although it's been on an incline ever since the 1970s, when the Supreme Court first ruled that spending money on politics on behalf of billionaires or corporations was protected by the First Amendment. This was the Buckley versus Vallejo case in 1976. It was wrongly decided then, and it has set our democratic republic on a course that is neither democratic nor republican, in the classic sense of both words with the lowercase DNR. Now, the interesting thing, and this is another piece here. This Robert Federici and Jonathan Stray over at ProPublica. It's reprinted on Daily Beast. The super rich have a new way to buy elections. 16% of all money raised by super PACs went to one donor committees. We talked about this briefly yesterday. So the country has confronted this in the past. This was pretty much the situation. I mean, the way things are right now is pretty much the way things were in 1929. There was a massive accumulation throughout the 20s. In 1920, Warren Harding was elected on basically Ronald Reagan's platform. This is 1920. His slogan was more business in government, less government in business. In other words, more business in government, privatize, and less government in business, deregulate. And that led to, you know, an 8-year, 9-year boom and then a massive stock market crash, just like Reaganomics stimulated the economy, but by turning it into a bubble, which burst in 2008 and I think, you know, is going to burst again, frankly. So what did FDR say about Warren Harding's Reaganomics policies that ruled the Harding, the Coolidge, and the Hoover administrations during the Roaring Twenties? This is 1936. It's a letter to Congress, to the 75th Congress, on antitrust laws from Franklin Roosevelt. He says, "Unhappy events have retaught us two simple truths about the liberty of a democratic people." Now, keep in mind, this is 1936. Hitler has risen to power in Germany. Mussolini has risen to power in Italy. I don't know about Franco in Spain. I think he's there. I'm not sure if the Spanish Civil War. I don't know that history, frankly. But that's what he's talking about, fascism. Because he goes on to say, the first truth is that the liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power to a point where it becomes stronger than their democratic state itself. That, in its essence, is fascism. Ownership of government by an individual, by a group, or by any other controlling private power. The second truth is that the liberty of a democracy is not safe if its business system does not provide employment and produce and distribute goods in such a way as to sustain an acceptable standard of living. The liberty of a democracy is not safe if workers don't make a living wage, essentially, is what he's saying here. And in fact, as a result of monopolistic practices by businesses throughout the 1920s, mergers and acquisitions, the bigger getting bigger and bigger and bigger, this was the situation in the United States at that time. Franklin Roosevelt goes on to say, this concentration is seriously impairing the economic effectiveness of private enterprise as a way of providing employment for labor and capital. And I'd say it's the same right now. I mean, a lot of our unemployment we can track back to mergers and acquisitions. You have five companies that are separate companies. Each one has its own bookkeeper. Each one has its own lawyer. Each one has its own CEO. Each one has its own officers. They merge into one company, and four out of the five CPAs get laid off. Four out of the five lawyers get laid off. Four out of the five support staff get laid off. Four out of the five administrative staff. You know, it's like, boom, you got a whole bunch of layoffs. So how do we go about, what do we do about this? Well, FDR continues. He says, looking at the Internal Revenue Statistics for 1935, he says 0.1% of corporations in America own 52% of the assets of all of them. Fewer than 5% of them owned 87% of the assets of all of them. 0.1% of them earned 50% of the net income of all of them. And then he goes on to add, the statistical history of modern times proves that in times of depression, concentration of business speeds up. Bigger business then has larger opportunity to grow still bigger at the expense of small competitors who are weakened by the financial adversity. He talks about how 1929 was the top year for people owning stock, because before the bubble burst in October of 1929, everybody, it seemed, was buying stock, right? That's what we've all been told. You know, the shoeshine boys were buying stock. He goes on to add, but in that year, 1929, 0.3% of our population received 78% of the dividends reported by individuals. 0.3%. So we're back, you know, it's not, frankly, it's not quite as bad as it is now. But it was pretty bad. He says 47% of all American families and single individuals living alone on incomes of had incomes of less than $1,000 for the entire year. And at the other end of the ladder, a little less than 1.5% of the nation's families received incomes which in dollars and cents reached the same total as the incomes of the 47% at the bottom. 33% of the property that was passed on by inheritance was found in only 4% of the reporting estates. We believe in a way of living in which political democracy and free private enterprise for profit should serve and protect each other to ensure a maximum of human liberty, but not for a few, but for all. He adds, it has been well said that the freest government, if it could exist, would not be long acceptable if the tendency of the laws were to create a rapid accumulation of property in a few hands and to render the great mass of the population dependent and penniless. Welcome to today. FDR goes on to diagnose the problem, and then he offers some very specific solutions. And I want to put those in historical context, too. So stick around and pay attention. This is amazing stuff going on. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's 1929 all over again. What do we need to learn from the lessons of the last great crisis? Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And Gary, watching Free Speech TV in Sterlington, Louisiana. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind?
I find it kind of ironic, Tom, that the Republican people are, you know, pushing business and now they kind of turned around on these questions in Indiana and Arkansas, whereas the major corporations, IBM, Walmart, and all of them are saying, hey, you can't discriminate against them. We got people working there and trying to recruit people to go in there. Mm-hmm. You can't do that.
So I don't understand. What happened in Arkansas and Louisiana, or Indiana, rather, that I missed? What are you talking about?
Trying to pass those religious freedom bills.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. Okay, so in the context of those so-called religious freedom, it's basically freedom to discriminate against gay people bills. What was your point?
It was against the Republican religious right.
Right. I didn't understand where you were starting with that, Gary. So the point that you made didn't connect in my brain. So now that I know where you're starting with this, that you're talking about the religious freedom bills, what was your point?
Well, now it's not going to happen in Louisiana. Bobby Jindal's going to push it all the way through.
Oh, he's going to push one of these bills through, too.
IBM has already planned, and they just announced a 400-employee increase in Monroe, a new facility to support CenturyLink.
Yeah.
And now they're coming out against Jindal, and I wouldn't be surprised if they pull that project because of it.
That will be very interesting. And you know, so here we have a government that has been corrupted not by business, but by the church, right? By religious leaders. And that government corruption by religious leaders is starting to upset the business interests. So we've got three actors here. Do I have this right, Gary?
Yes, you do. I've been thinking about it for days. It's ironic that
you're
turning back on the people that want these bills.
It really is. And apropos of FDR's comments back in 1936, which I'm going to get back to in 2 minutes, he was not dealing in 1936 with the religious right. It was the religious right was created by the Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers in the 1940s and in the 1950s when they pulled out Billy Graham and decided to fund him big time and turn him into a national rock star. And he got the National Prayer Breakfast started, and he got the religious right started, and then Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and all those other guys came along and rode that train. But the religious right in this country, it's another group just like the billionaires that has captured the Republican Party. It's really astonishing. It really is.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Gary, for the call. It's great to hear from you. So Gary's essentially the question, I guess, is do we not only need to have a Sherman Act to break up big corporations? Do we need to figure out some way to break up big Christian money? The mega churches, the empires that are out there that are all nonprofit. You and I support all of them. We fund all of them. Because we pay for their police, we pay for their fire, we pay for their roads, we pay for all of the infrastructure that they use. They simply keep all the money. That's pretty astonishing, too. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past noon. Okay, FDR, this is 1936, and this is not a speech he gave, so I can't play audio of it for you. This is a fairly long document that he wrote, which is titled the FDR's Message to the 75th Congress on Enforcing Antitrust Laws. And he says, we believe in a way of living in which political democracy and free private enterprise for profit should serve and protect each other to ensure a maximum of human liberty, not for a few, but for all. It has well been said, he said, the freest government. I already read that to you. Render the great master of the pie. Well, I'll read it again. It has well been said, the freest government, if it could exist, would not be long acceptable if the tendency of the laws were to create a rapid accumulation of property in a few hands and to render the great mass of the population dependent and penniless. By the way, did you see where the Koch brothers have said that they are basically endorsing Scott Walker, as I've been predicting for, years? ever since Scott Walker took that phone call from the guy that he thought was David Koch and basically swooned all over him, did everything but ask him to marry him. Well, it was more like a subordinate boss relationship. How did I do, boss? Huh? How did I do? Huh? Oh yeah, we're gonna kick their butts. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. When that happened, I thought, okay, Scott Walker is the perfect toady. You know, Rand Paul, he's begging the Kochs for money. He's going, I'm the libertarian. You know, you ran for libertarian vice president in 1980, David Koch. Give me the money. They're looking at Rand Paul going, this guy's not going to win. This guy's a loose cannon. Scott Walker, you know, the Koch brothers put, no doubt, a fair amount of the money into helping him overcome his recall election. But what they know is that the guy, he's like Nixon. Scott Walker's the closest thing we've had to Nixon. Anyhow, back to FDR. He says, if there is a danger, it comes from that concentrated private economic power which is struggling so hard to master our democratic government. I was just talking about the Koch brothers and their, you know, all of the Americans for Prosperity ads against Obamacare. It was the efforts of these guys, not just the Koch brothers, but this whole right-wing cabal that took Obamacare to the Supreme Court that now allows the Republican governors to Republican legislators to say to poor working poor people in states like Florida, hey, screw you, Charlene Dill, go ahead and die. Well, she did. And Rick Scott has her blood on his hands. How can that man sleep at night? He says, if there is that danger, it comes from our concentrated private economic power, which is struggling so hard to master our democratic government. It will not come, as some of the possessors of that private power would make the people believe, from our democratic government itself. The danger. Okay, so he's saying, you don't have to worry about the government. You got to worry about private industry. He says, even these statistics I have cited do not measure the actual degree of concentration of control over American industry. Close financial control through locking spheres of influence. He's talking about it creates close control of the business policies of enterprises which masquerade as independent units. So you've got like, you know, four companies that basically own the entire food supply of the United States, or 80 or 90% of it. But they operate under hundreds of brand names. You've got 11,000 magazines in the United States and newspapers that are published by fewer than 10 companies. You've got, you know, radio and television stations that operate with independent names. They don't say, hey, it's Clear Channel, hey, it's Cumulus. But, you know, the ownership is incredibly concentrated. So FDR says, private enterprise is ceasing to be free enterprise and is becoming a cluster of private collectivisms. Masking itself as a system of free enterprise after the American model, it is in fact becoming a concentrated cartel system after the European model. An industrial empire building, he writes, unfortunately, has evolved into banker control of industry. We oppose that. Such control does not offer safety for the investing public. He says, in output per man or machine, we are the most efficient industrial nation on earth, but in the manner of complete mutual employment of capital and labor, we are among the least efficient. If you believe with me in private initiative, you must acknowledge the right of well-managed small businesses to make reasonable profits. You must admit that the destruction of this opportunity for small businesses to make profits follows concentration of control of any given industry into a small number of dominating corporations. If private enterprise left to its own devices becomes half regimented and half competitive, half slave and half free, as it is today, it obviously cannot adjust itself to meet the needs and demands of the country. I have consistently urged a federal wages and hours bill to take the minimum decencies of life for the working man and women out of the field of competition. He's proposing a minimum wage. We must revive and strengthen competition. The justification of private property, private profit, is private risk. We cannot safely make America safe for the businessman who does not want to take the burdens and risks of being a businessman. This is no people, least of all a people with our traditions of personal liberty, will endure the slow erosion of opportunity for the common man, the oppressive state of helplessness under the dominion of a few which are overshadowing our whole economic life. That, in its essence, is fascism, ownership of government by an individual, a group, or other private controlling power.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
So we've asked this question in the context of the Mussolini's definition, but by FDR's definition, has America become fascist? Are the Koch brothers the leading edge? 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. Just a couple of quick headlines here. Just looking at The Guardian, this is incredibly ironic. The Republicans have been refusing to consider Loretta Lynch's confirmation because the Democrats won't vote on this human trafficking bill that the Republicans passed out of the House of Representatives that includes a provision that says that if you're a woman or a girl who was kidnapped and trafficked, in other words, kidnapped into prostitution, basically, and you became pregnant as a result of that, that it is illegal for our government to pay for your abortion. Okay, no money can be used to even help you figure out how to get an abortion. Now that's the bill, the human sex trafficking bill that the Democrats in the Senate are saying, no, we're not going to vote on that. And Mitch McConnell is saying, therefore, I'm not going to bring up Loretta Lynch's nomination. Listen to this from The Guardian. This is just the lead paragraph. Republican leaders say they'll hold up Lynch's confirmation until the trafficking bill passes. And yet Lynch has been one of America's boldest pursuers of sex traffickers, Guardian Review reveals. She's the poster child for making this kind of legislation work. It's amazing. Okay, a couple other quick things. Six officers suspended over death of Freddie Gray. In the mental health area, mindfulness therapy as good as antidepressants for depression. In Japan, the maglev train broke the world speed record. In the United States, Amtrak is having to go slower and slower and slower because our old privately owned for-profit corporate rail system is falling apart. Oh, and Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi apparently has been seriously wounded in an airstrike. So, yeah. Anyhow, all that stuff. Back to FDR. I want to just a little bit more of this. He says, no people, least of all a people with our traditions of personal liberty, will endure the slow erosion of opportunity for the common man, the oppressive sense of helplessness under the domination of a few which are overshadowing our whole economic life. The power of a few to manage the economic life of a nation must be diffused among the many or be transferred to the public and its democratically responsible government. In other words, you know, business has screwed this thing up bad. And we have to be the counterweight. We, the people, government. This is why the whole big government meme, this is why it, you know, for 40, 50 years, billionaires and big corporations have spent hundreds of millions of dollars to get their shills out there on TV, you know, the George Wills of the world, to get the Stephen Moores of the world, the Republican politicians of the world, to get them on TV to talk about the evils of big government, because big government is the only thing strong enough to take on big business. And big business doesn't like that. You understand how this works? So when you hear some Tea Partier or some Republican or the guy who works next to you go off on, government's too big, you know that you're talking to a sucker. One of the people who has been successfully brought along in the Republican Party is made up of rich people, shills, and suckers. One of the people who has been brought along by the shills. FDR goes, these people in and out of the halls of government who encourage the growing restriction of competition are shouldering a terrific responsibility. The restriction of competition, what he's talking about is mergers and acquisitions. They are working for centralized business and financial control. They are therefore either working for control of the government itself by business and finance, or the other alternative, a growing concentration of public power in the government to cope with such a concentration of private power. In other words, if you don't like big government, break up big business. Use the antitrust laws. He said the enforcement of free competition is the least regulation business can expect. The traditional approach to the problems I have discussed has been through the antitrust laws. That approach we do not propose to abandon. To meet the situation I've described, there should be a more thorough study of the concentration of economic power in American industry and the effect of that upon the decline of competition. I would suggest that we're a corporation. Now, keep in mind, you know, like Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan Chase, you know, the company is convicted of crimes, felonies. They pay a fine, and then he goes and sits in Elizabeth Warren's office, and she says, I think what you're doing is against the law. And he says, so fine me. Leans back, puts his feet up on her desk or something like that. So this is what FDR said. As a really effective deterrent to personal wrongdoing, I would suggest that where a corporation is enjoined from violating the law, in other words, if a corporation gets nailed the way Chase has, the court might be empowered to enjoin the corporation for a specified period of time from giving any remunerative employment or any official position to any person who has been found to bear a responsibility for the wrongful corporate action. In other words, all the people at J.P. Morgan Chase who participated in the crime of which that bank was convicted, if they're not going to go to jail, at least the law could say they may no longer work there. They would lose their jobs. He says, as a further deterrent to corporate wrongdoing, the government might well be authorized to withhold government purchases from companies guilty of unfair or monopolistic practices. Sorry, defense contractors A, B, C, and D, you are too big. You are unfair monopolies. I'm sorry, J.P. Morgan Chase, but we're not going to run our food stamp things through you anymore because you're guilty of unfair monopoly. In fact, he gets into banks. He says bank holding companies. Now, they used to call them holding companies back in the 30s. Now we just call them banks. You know, J.P. Morgan Chase used to be like, you know, a bunch of other banks. And they all merged together into this one. And is the same is true of the other big five banks. He says it's hardly necessary to point out the great economic power that might, that might be wielded by a group which may succeed in acquiring domination over banking resources in any considerable area of the country. It's amazing. Anyhow, let me pick up some phone calls here. I'm losing my voice. It's my body's way of saying shut up and listen. Will in Blakeslee, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing? I am so happy you are pounding this fascism discussion now because it is long overdue. Yes, we are obviously in the grips of fascism. And beyond that, it's safe to say it now. It is so naked. In my circle of people that I hang with, we've been using some for a long time, but even Republicans now understand, generally speaking, that I know personally, understand much better now what that means. They know it doesn't mean Nazism. So, yeah, we are, and I'm so happy you're doing this. We need so much education on that. And these FDR clips you play, they are fantastic because FDR is accepted by he's acceptable to right wingers because, well, frankly, he's old and dead and white, and they listen to him. That resonates with them, you know, of course, because he's an old president who doesn't live he's not alive anymore, and frankly, you know, they're not threatened by his race. So, yes, we are in the grips of fascism, and we damn well better start doing something about it now before it's too late.
Amen, Will. Yeah. And I agree with FDR that the best solution is application of the antitrust laws. We need to start aggressively breaking up these big companies. Will, and prevent the Time Warner Comcast merger that actually it looks like the Department of, what is it, Commerce? I think looks that over, Department of State, whatever it is. He's starting to get pretty sketchy about it. Will, thanks a lot for the call. Amen to everything you said. Steve in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Steve, you have a story about billionaires?
Hey. The statistic that you quoted earlier when you first came on.
Oh, that billionaires are spending more to buy lobby members of Congress than we pay to establish Congress itself.
Yes, I mean, I almost drove off the road. I mean, I'm pissed off enough at Congress as it is, but once you put a number to what we're basically pissing away on this incompetent group of self-righteous, self-motivated idiots, just absolutely floored me.
Yeah.
And
that ain't nothing, by the way. I mean, that's just that's just the beginning. That's just the U.S. Congress. It's happening in every state house around the country. It's now happening in cities and counties. The Koch brothers and their billionaire buddies, in addition to helping create and fund ALEC, which brings state Republican only Republican legislators, state legislators, together with, well, maybe there's a few right-wing Dems in there, but when Mark Pocan tried to crash their party, they threw him out. So anyhow, that ALEC program was just for state legislatures. Now they got a new program, I forget the name of it, that is just for towns and counties. I mean, they're going all the way down to the bottom, right? The dog catcher. I mean, they're trying to get everybody. So it's a real mess, Steve. It's a real mess.
Well, and being in Florida and having to witness the Rick Scott era has been extremely painful as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got a criminal in charge of your state. You've got a guy who was the head of the company that engaged in the largest Medicare fraud in the history of the United States, maybe the history of the world. And, you know, he walked off with $70 million and had enough money to buy himself a governorship and kind of sanitize his background. It's amazing. I mean, even Daryl Issa has succeeded in scrubbing off his Wikipedia page, his sordid past. It's just incredible, Steve. Thank you for the call. I mean, Daryl Issa, again, you know, worth hundreds of millions. I think he's worth $700 million. The richest or second richest guy in the House of Representatives. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
For example, Ted Cruz is only in this race because either three or four private individuals have come up with millions of dollars for him. What's wrong with that? Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Rich watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Rich, what's on your mind?
Hey, our wonderful hospitals up here have been privatized by this LifePoint system. Are you there still?
I am. I'm listening.
Okay, cool. I couldn't hear you there for a second.
Yep.
Anyways, I went yesterday to acquire some of my medical records, and they told me that for 20 sheets of paper, it was going to cost me $42.
Whoa.
And I ended up arguing with them, and I finally
What happened to 5 cents a copy? I mean, $42 for 20 sheets of paper?
Yes. And then I've got another friend that's also at the same hospital. They botched an operation on her. She had a hysterectomy, and she's got some kind of infection, and she's sicker than a dog. And they refuse to do the ultrasound that they need to do to redo this operation until she pays $25 of the $50 she owes for a co-charge.
Wow.
And this kind of stuff is rampant up here.
Yeah, this is, it's the invasion of corporate profit-seeking activity into what should be the public sphere. Public health is called public health for a reason. It's the public, right?
I don't understand is how people could put money over somebody's life, their well-being. It boggles my mind. I just...
Yeah, well, have a conversation with any of those Republican legislators in the red states that have not expanded Medicaid. And, whether these people are ideologues or whether they are sociopaths or whether this is the extent of their shill sold outedness. I don't know which it is, but it's pretty grim. Rich, thank you for the call. Excellent story. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Dr. Tom. I'm trying to figure out how to make this quick, but I got to wondering about these religious people. Their religious freedom is more important than anyone's civil rights. And when you look at Hobby Lobby and then you look at these people, they don't want to serve someone who's gay. Well, then I get to thinking about all the corporations here that are primarily owned by Saudi Arabia, like Comcast. They're trying to buy Time Warner.
Comcast is not owned by Saudi Arabia. It's owned by a very, very wealthy, very right-wing family that I think is mostly in Florida.
They're 52% owned, I believe. The prince bought it before the king died.
I think.
Really? I may be wrong.
No. Yeah, you are. I'm quite sure you are. The Saudis, now a Saudi prince, what's his name, Al Talawid, used to own 7% of Fox News. And, you know, yeah. He's the second largest stockholder in Fox up until this last year, behind Rupert Murdoch. But he sold off all but, I think, 1% or 2% of his stock.
Well, but, I got to wondering, though, if they do so own so much of our country and so many different corporations, what would these right-wing religious people do if someone who owns, an Islamic person owns a major food chain and they say, we're no longer going to sell beer or pork products in our stores? Would that wake up America when they lose their freedom to do tailgating?
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, that's already the case. Businesses are perfectly, you know, there are kosher delis and they don't sell food that's not kosher. They're halal. Places that don't sell food that's not halal. So not necessarily the best example, Norma, but I absolutely get what you're talking about. And I don't think corporations should have religious rights. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 10 minutes before the hour, and Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hi, good afternoon, Tom.
Hey, Charles.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to start off with what you were talking about with FDR.
Mm-hmm.
And with all the gains that we've made as workers in this country who contribute everything to the economy and, you know, to a better life, everything that we've accomplished as far as the labor union, we have to, as you can see, it can be taken away. We have to start making strides where it has to be a constitutional amendment for abortion, for a minimum wage, you know, for protections that labor unions take, because it's always, even if we make the gain, basically what they're saying is no matter how long it takes from all the way from the 40s till now, they're going to try to strip away every gain that we make.
Yep.
And one last thing.
And they've taken a lot of them already, Charles.
Exactly. And here's my example of that as well. I was listening to Larry Summers. I believe he was on CNN this weekend. And basically, he was saying everything that we as progressives have been just crying about for the last 6 or 7 years, that we need infrastructure. And his basic argument was, you know, if we don't build the roads, if we don't build back our buildings, these federal buildings that we all depend on, we're leaving that up to our kids. So we're leaving a debt to them that's probably, you know, insurmountable as well.
Yeah.
So every time I hear Fox, I keep on hearing they don't want to leave this debt behind for their children, but they're actually doing it now. You know, we don't need to talk about Iran, and we don't need to talk about Loretta Lynch. Let's talk about the economy, and then they might want to talk about Loretta Lynch.
Yeah.
Let us put an emphasis back on putting entrepreneurs out there that's going to also bring competition.
Right, but entrepreneurs can only thrive and survive in a genuinely competitive environment, which we no longer have in the United States because we've got all this, you know, basically large corporate control of, you know, entire industrial sectors. Charles, thank you for the call. Excellent point all. I found this fascinating. Shano actually discovered this. This New York Times piece, Amy Chozick, a newcomer to populism, Hillary Clinton campaign begs to differ. Basically, you know, they're trying to reinvent her or invent her or whatever you want to call it, as a populist, as a progressive populist. And buried at the end of the story, and I don't know if this is, I mean, this should have been the lead. Right? Hillary Clinton commits to take down billionaires. At the end of the story, and I quote, in a meeting with economists this year, Mrs. Clinton intensely studied a chart that showed income inequality in the United States. The chart showed how real wages adjusted for inflation had increased exponentially for the wealthiest Americans, making the bar so steep it hardly fit on the chart. Mrs. Clinton pointed at the top category and said the economy required a, quote, toppling, end quote, of the wealthiest 1%, according to several people who were briefed on Mrs. Clinton's policy discussions but could not discuss private conversations for attribution. Still, Mrs. Clinton will pitch that toppling with a very different style than Mrs. Warren, a bankruptcy expert whose populist message has been laser-focused on holding Wall Street accountable. It's very interesting. Again, not a pitch for Hillary Clinton, but you know, why is the fact that one of the presidential candidates is willing to take on billionaires not a headline? But the fact that the billionaires have decided to fund Scott Walker, that is a headline. It's like our news media have decided to celebrate how bad this is. Neil in Dayville, Connecticut. Hey, Neil, what's up?
Hey, I appreciate you taking the call.
Sure. My pleasure.
I talk a lot about this. And, you know, 20 years ago when you were talking about fascism, you lost people. And so what I figured out is that you had to divorce the idea of fascism from the Nazis. And I started using the term neo-fascism.
Mm.
And that's something people can get their head around, because
right.
It's not the same thing. Doesn't have to have a leader named Adolf goose-stepping. It's about corporations and wealth controlling your government.
Right, and it is the new fascism. This is a modern version of what Mussolini envisioned.
Exactly. Now, what I think we need in America is the birth of a representative democracy as part of a republic. And when I say that, people look at me and say, isn't that what we already have? No, what we have is a representative plutocracy rapidly emerging into full-out fascism. And so what that essentially means, or what that intrinsically means, is right now you get to vote and put people in office. But once they're in office, what happens in Washington happens based on who paid who how much money. And
correct.
That's got to end.
Yep.
We got to have a voice in the process after the election.
Yep. I'm totally with you. Totally with you. Neil, thank you. Excellent points. Miguel in Chicago. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Just something really quick. Big fan, by the way. I was born in Chicago, and I grew up in Guadalajara, Mexico, back in the 80s. I'm 36 now. My mom always used to feed us a lot of good food. When we came back to the States, the junk food, I mean, she would literally just give us that when she was always working.
Right.
I saw a documentary yesterday called Fed Up. And it talks about back in the 80s when they had no kids with diabetes. And as of 2010, 57,000 cases, I believe, a year.
Right.
Which is really bad.
Because we're all eating junk
everything
food.
Everything is involved with money, Tom.
Yep.
Scary.
Yeah.
You know?
So you're saying that the corporate control and fascism, essentially, the corporate takeover of our food supply is killing us.
That's correct. And the funny thing is that all these, as you mentioned a little while ago, all these big corporations own little small corporations,
right.
Which is putting different names on it, having different products, which is ultimately the same crap food that we always eat.
Yeah, yeah, I'm with you, Miguel. Thanks a lot for the call. Excellent point. And from your own personal experience, much appreciated. We will be back. We got a lot coming up today. Neil McCabe is going to drop by. And we are going to discuss what has the Republican Party done for us recently. And then in our third hour, Dar Jamail is going to drop by. We're going to be talking about what's going on down in the Gulf.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, this is fascinating. The Supreme Court just said, welcome back, by the way. The Supreme Court just voted 6-3. The decision just came down to say that if you are stopped by a police officer for a traffic stop, for a taillight out or an illegal, you know, left turn or whatever, that they can't then say to you, now wait here while we bring the drug-sniffing dog. This guy had been stopped. They thought he might have drugs. That's not why they stopped him. They stopped him for a traffic violation. And it took 10 minutes for the drug-sniffing dog to get there. The drug-sniffing dog, sure enough, found methamphetamine. And the guy went to jail. This case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said in her majority opinion, this was 6-3, that prolonging the traffic stop beyond the time needed to deal with the initial offense was improper, even if only for a few minutes. Fascinating stuff. So anyhow, last week we played the clip of this Tea Partier, a fellow by the name of James Webb, who says to his viewers, well, actually, let me just share with you James Webb himself. He runs a, it's called Hot Lead Retired, right? Which is, he's a retired guy in his 50s, and he's all about shooting guns, thus the Hot Lead. And this is what he had to say.
And I voted for Republican for 32 years. I'm a charter member of my Tea Party Patriot chapter. I'm also a veteran of the U.S. Army. I asked myself, I said, which party has helped me out the most in the last, I don't know, 15 years, 20? And it was the Democrat Party, the Democrats. The Republican Party, they hadn't done nothing for me, man, nothing. So, I'm leaning toward voting for Hillary, unless something major comes up. I don't trust the Republicans anymore. They're wanting to repeal the Obamacare.
Yeah, and he kind of likes that Obamacare. So, Neil McCabe is on the line with us, conservative columnist with townhall.com, editor of the Washington Mercury News, thewashingtonmercury.com. Neil, welcome back. Neil?
Yeah, hi. Can you?
Yeah, hey.
Okay.
We're on the air.
That guy really fills the screen, doesn't he, Tom?
Yeah, he does. He gets right up to the camera and talks into it. So why should anybody who is not rich vote for Republicans? Because I can give you a long list of things that Democrats have given us, Social Security, Medicare, the Peace Corps, unemployment insurance, civil rights, student loan programs, safety laws, environmental laws, prevailing wage laws, right to collective bargaining, paid insurance, paid vacations, pensions, workers' compensation, the Marshall Plan, flood disasters,
school lunch.
Fair Labor Standards Act, minimum wage, child labor laws, 40-hour week, every single one of these things opposed by Republicans, every single one. Can you tell me what?
By me.
Pardon?
Right now, as I live and breathe, Tom.
All opposed by you as we stand and talk.
Why
should anybody who is not either rich or paid by rich people vote for a Republican?
Well, I think that's the first problem. I've always said that one of the reasons why Republicans lose elections when they lose is they try to outbid the Democrats with voters. You can't outbid the Democrats. They don't care how much money they borrow from China or how much money they print up at the Federal Reserve. You cannot outbid the Democrats. So, I mean, if you want to know who's going to give you the most free stuff, well, yeah, it has to be the Democrats, of course.
Okay, now hang on just a second, Neil. Let's qualify this statement. I get it.
From?
No, hold on. You're making the argument that Democrats are basically bribing voters by doing what voters want. And I don't disagree with you that that's what's going on. And in fact, I think that that is how democracy is supposed to work. You're supposed to get the government you want.
But the
giant caveat we need to put on what you just said is if you're in the bottom 90%, then nobody can outbid the government in terms of, you know, giving you Social Security and making sure that you get a decent paycheck. But if you're in the top 1%,
right,
nobody can outbid the government in protecting your oil companies, your shipping lanes. Nobody can outbid the government in your oil depletion allowance. Nobody can outbid the government in the defense industry.
We've agreed in the past that corporate welfare is a problem, and we're against it. Crony capitalism is a problem, and I think we're both against
but
it.
But Republicans are not against this. They filibustered at least three pieces of legislation that I can think of that Nancy Pelosi passed in the first 2 years of the Obama administration that would have stopped crony capitalism.
Do you support the import-export bank?
The import-export bank, again, is the sort of thing. This is the...
I would get rid of it. I'm telling you right now.
I don't really care. The import-export bank is a pimple on the butt of an elephant. The elephant here is the probably 500 or 600, maybe a couple thousand at the most, giant corporations and billionaires like the Koch brothers and the Walton family who have their hands out, and the government is pouring a never-ending stream of money into their hands, and of course, and then the Republicans are making sure that it's always there. So yeah, if you're rich, vote Republican. I get that, but why?
Like a guy like James Webb. Talk about this guy who describes himself as a charter member of his Tea Party.
Right.
If he's an Army veteran,
right,
he probably, I'm guessing from his age, he might have enjoyed that 25% pay increase that he got under Ronald Reagan. He might have enjoyed some of the new equipment that the Democrats voted against. He might have enjoyed the health benefits, the housing, and the other things that if he was a career
soldier. Now, I've had people pitch that, you know, Reagan raised the pay of the military a couple of times on this program, and what happens every time somebody says that is veterans who were in active duty in the 1980s call up and go, no, it wasn't Reagan who did it. And it wasn't 25%.
I'll tell you flat out, it was Reagan.
It went into effect during Reagan's administration. It was set up before he became president.
Did he sign it?
No, I don't believe so. I think it was Jimmy Carter.
In 1980, he campaigned on it. He didn't stop it. So it may have been in the works, but he didn't stop it.
Yeah. If your point, Neil, is that average working people should vote for Republicans because once 40 years ago, a Republican president signed a piece of legislation that raised the pay of the military that was no doubt supported by all the Democrats, I don't think that's going to fly.
There
are independent voters listening and watching, Neil. Here's your opportunity to give a sales pitch. Why should the average working person vote for a Republican?
Well, I think flat out we should go back to what Abraham Lincoln said the purpose of government was. The purpose of government is to take the burden off of the shoulders and to clear the path so that people can make their American dream and not put things in the way. Now, this guy Webb, he's talking about, you know, when you listen to his statement, he's talking about, you know, that the Democrats and Obama have given him, you know, subsidized gym membership, which I'm not convinced.
Well, this is like what Lincoln did so that people could have that clear way. He funded 56 land grant colleges, free college education for every student in the United States.
Yeah,
that was Lincoln.
I don't think we're ready to strip the land grant colleges, Tom, but
we already have. Reagan did. They used to be free.
Obamacare thing. I mean, the purpose of Obamacare, I'm convinced, was not to improve health care. It was to give hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars, to Democratic operatives, connected computer companies, PR firms.
No, that was the purpose of Medicare Part D.
So huge boondoggle. If you took them, you could actually say the money we've spent setting up Obamacare, if we had just divided it up and paid insurance premiums, we might have actually moved the needle.
Well, there I'm not going to argue with you, Neil. The money that we spent setting up Obamacare went to private for-profit corporations who totally screwed it up. And I think that the government should have hired good programmers, given them good government jobs with a pension so that they're absolutely committed to their work and they're not, you know,
To be a better way. But you couldn't talk about it. You couldn't talk about Obamacare because of the way the Democrats blocked things in Congress. This guy Webb, I mean, he's retired at 50.
Yeah. Isn't that great?
Well, isn't that great?
He's probably on a military pension.
Well, the Democrats made that possible. I hope he enjoys himself because the rest of us are working.
Okay. Neil McCabe. Vote for okay, got it. Thank you, Neil.
And get to work.
Yeah, okay.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I got to go back to work here. 15 minutes past the hour. Thank you, Neil. And welcome back 15 minutes past the hour. That's funny. If you know, when government does things for billionaires, it's called stimulating the economy. When government does things for average working people, at least in a Republican lexicon, when the government does things for average working people, it's called buying votes. Right? Well, why do you think that the Koch brothers are going to spend $900 million on the next election? Could it be that they think that that's in their interests? And not just the Koch brothers, obviously. Anita in San Antonio, Texas, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Anita, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom.
Hey.
Yeah, I want to talk about something you mentioned earlier about how more money is coming from lobbyists than from taxpayers to fund Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I think what, now I know this is probably not a popular position right now, as unpopular as Congress is, but I think what we need to do is we need to start putting more money into Congress.
Yes.
Because what Newt Gingrich Congress did was they cut funding for research staff
yep.
to Congress.
Yep.
So now what they've ended up having to do is rely on lobbyists to
right.
explain issues to them.
That's right. They rely on things like
legislation.
Yeah.
So yeah. if we put more money into Congress, and I know that would probably not fly right now, but that's basically one of the problems. I mean, what the solutions?
I agree with you. And I think it would be a good idea. I think it would be a very good idea. Anita, thank you for the call. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Hey, Ed, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
I've been considering this corporate responsibility thing for some time, and I've come to the conclusion that we need a pass-through provision for the criminal aspect of what the corporation does so that the CEO can be held criminally responsible for the corporation committing murder or environmental pollution or whatever. The criminal penalty should be, you know, the fine's fine for the corporation, but the criminal penalty needs to go to the man on top. And
agreed.
Then if he claims willful ignorance, we should double the penalty. Whatever, if it would have been 7 years for manslaughter, we give him 14 years for willful ignorance.
Well, FDR, I mean, in this document that I opened the previous hour with, FDR's letter to the 75th Congress back in 1936, he explicitly said if a corporation is involved, I'm paraphrasing now, but he explicitly said that if a corporation is involved in criminal activity, all of the employees of that corporation should be forbidden by law from working for that corporation anymore, ever, and from working in that industry.
We need to go beyond that. I think we need to jail them. I think we need to give them the criminal penalty. And, you know, the fine is paid by the corporation, but the criminal time is done by the CEO.
I agree. Actually, what Roosevelt was referring to wasn't criminal activity. It was antitrust activity. But you're right. You're absolutely right.
Anybody that wants to claim that nobody told me, well, then that's willful ignorance, and you get double the penalty. Whatever the penalty would have been, you get double it for claiming that nobody told me.
Right, right. Because when Jamie Dimon basically told Elizabeth Warren to, you know, bug off by saying, just go, you know, she said, I think what you're doing is criminal, and this was in a private meeting in her office, and he leaned back and put his hands up behind his head and then says, so go ahead and find me. He wasn't really saying, find me, Jamie Dimon. He was saying, fine J.P. Morgan Chase, because the bank can take the fine, they can make a tax deductible, they can, you know, yeah. And it really needs to be jail me. Ed, thank you very much for the call. We'll be right back, 20 minutes past the hour. Here with you. Speaking of Social Security, Martin O'Malley has said some really good stuff recently. I'm very interested in Martin O'Malley. And Hillary Clinton is starting to say some really interesting things. She said, for example, yesterday, catch this, there's a lot of loose talk about Social Security, and I don't know how people can make some of the arguments they make, because if you look at how dependent so many people are on their Social Security, they worked hard for it. They retire. They postpone retirement as long as possible because they want to keep working, but they also want to get the maximum amount of payout from Social Security. The Social Security Trust Fund, according to the trustees, will be solvent until 2035. So what do we do to make sure that it's there and we don't mess with it and we don't pretend that it's a luxury? Because it is not a luxury. It is a necessity for the majority of people who draw Social Security. I think there'll be some big political arguments about Social Security. And my only question to everybody who thinks we can privatize Social Security or undermine it in some other way, and what is going to happen to all those people who worked 27 years at the Southern Company? What's going to happen? It's just wrong. Everyone take a deep breath. Wow. Again, So George Bush, excuse me, Jeb Bush, meanwhile, it's amazing. Jeb Bush is preparing to embark in an experiment, according to Thomas Beaumont with the Associated Press, in an experiment in presidential politics, delegating many of the nuts and bolts tasks of seeking the White House to a separate political organization that can raise unlimited amounts of campaign cash. In other words, Jeb Bush is saying, doesn't even have to be my campaign. And campaigns have all these rules and regulations around them, right, that have been put into place over the last, well, all the way back to Teddy Roosevelt, the last 130 years, basically, or 110 years. And there's all these rules and regulations around a campaign. So Bush says, I'm not going to have my campaign do a lot of those things. I'm going to have a super PAC do them. They can raise unlimited amounts of dark money. They don't have to disclose who the money came from, and they can run all kinds of ads, and they can make me president, Jeb Bush says. This is how weird it's gotten. Somebody running for president of the United States, a government job, doing so with a super PAC funded by corporate money and billionaires who got their money from corporations. Doing it with a super PAC funded by corporate money so that he can have the, freedom to dance the tune of whatever particular billionaire gives him the most money? I mean, it's just, this is where our politics are today. And it's just, it's really, truly, fundamentally screwed up. Couple of other things I wanted to rant about today. Francis Robles and Shaila Dewan wrote a brilliant piece for the New York Times yesterday, or day before yesterday. It was titled "Skip Child Support, Go to Jail, Lose Job, Repeat." And they tell the story of Walter L. Walter Scott, the guy who was shot because he ran. By his own telling, the first time L. Scott went to jail for failure to pay child support, it sent his life into a tailspin. He lost what he called the best job I ever had when he spent 2 weeks in jail. Some years he paid, more recently he had not. 2 years ago, when his debt reached nearly $8,000 and he missed a court date, a warrant was issued for his arrest. By last month, that amount had more than doubled to just over $18,000. And then he gets pulled over for a broken taillight, and he runs, and he's fatally shot in the back. And the point that Francis and Shaila are making is that the child support laws, which can be fairly draconian, you'll recall back 20, 30 years ago, there was a lot of publicity about so-called deadbeat dads. And a lot of indignation, because a lot of these deadbeat dads were rich white guys. In fact, all of the publicity that I remember was about rich white guys. And how, here's this guy who's a multimillionaire who won't pay child support. Here's another guy who's a multimillionaire. Here's a guy who moved overseas so he could avoid paying child support. He's living on a desert island or whatever. And, on and on it goes. And so we put into place these really draconian child support laws that are targeted to the middle class. But what happens when they get hit? What happens when working poor people get hit with these same laws? Then they get devastated. So a law that's merely an inconvenience for somebody like me who has a good job and a reasonable income and if I had to pay child support, I could afford to do it, that's a whole completely world apart from somebody who is making $10,000 a year, working at Walmart or whatever, the local gas station, and can barely afford to pay their rent, much less pay child support. And we've criminalized the failure to pay child support because we got so upset about these rich white guys. Isn't it time to do something about that, to change that? That ties into this other piece, this 1.5 million missing black men. For every 100 black women not in jail, there are only 83 black men. The rest of them are, in a sense, missing. Among cities with sizable black populations, the single largest gap is in Ferguson, Missouri. North Charleston, South Carolina has a gap larger than 75% of cities. This gap, driven mostly by incarceration and early death, I mean, these men are literally missing from their communities, barely exists among whites. For out of every 100 white women, there's one missing white man. For every 100 black women, there are 40 missing black men in Ferguson, 25 missing black men in North Charleston, South Carolina, and 17 missing black men for every 100 black women throughout the United States. And I guarantee you child support had something to do with it. Now, I'm all in favor of people paying child support, but what happens when they can't? Not won't, but can't.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We've got to, you know, we really need to start from the ground up. So much damage has been done to so many of our laws in so many ways by Reaganomics. We've got to change this. Bad and the very, very trophophiliously ugly, the good, Martin O'Malley. In a new interview with NPR, the former Maryland governor and potential 2016 Democratic candidate for president blasted the Republican claim that regulation hurts the middle class. All right, when he was given that old canard by NPR, here's how he responded.
Is there some truth to that? You were a big city mayor. You know how government works.
No, I don't think there's any truth to that. Our tax code's been turned into Swiss cheese, and certainly the concentrated wealth and the accumulated power and the systematic deregulation of Wall Street has led to this situation where the economy isn't working for most of us. All of that is true, but it is not true that regulation holds poor people down or regulation keeps middle class from advancing. That's kind of patently
I couldn't have said it better myself, Governor. By the way, nice little rhetorical flourish there at the end. The bad. Congressman Dave Brat, in a recent interview on the Lars Larson show, the Republican Virginia congressman offered this absolutely brilliant critique of Obamacare. Take a listen.
You can make up all sorts of efficiency language and all, you know, cost reductions, whatever. It won't work. If you don't use the price system, you can look at every country in the world, right? Look at North Korea and South Korea. It's the same culture. It's the same people. Look on a map at night. Half the one of the countries is not lit. There's no lights. And the bottom free market country, all Koreans, is lit up.
That's right. Banning the worst abuses of the health insurance industry is going to turn America into North Korea. Top-notch analysis there, Congressman. And by the way, that very prosperous lit-up South Korea, they have one of the world's best national health insurance programs, paid for mostly by the government since 1977. And the very, very ugly Michael Savage. During a recent episode of his radio program, the right-wing talk show host blasted gay rights activists for writing an open letter to the Pope asking him to replace the Archbishop of San Francisco, who's come under fire for making homophobic comments. According to Savage, whose real name is Michael Weiner, the gay activists were acting like Nazis. Take a listen.
In their open letter to the Pope, these narrow-minded critics of the Archbishop say that his morality clause is mean-spirited and, quote, sets a pastoral tone that is close to persecution, closer to persecution than evangelization. No, they persecute the rest of us. That's how they do it. This is how bullies operate. They bully you and then say you're a bully for standing up to them. They're the bullies. The Nazis of today are these bullies.
Right, because nothing says Nazi like being in love. That's very, very ugly. Amazing. Sydney in Washington, D.C. Hey, Sydney, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Hey, I'm so excited to talk to you. I'm such a huge fan.
Thank you.
Every time I hear you talk about Governor O'Malley, he is such a phenomenal, he was a phenomenal governor.
Mm-hmm.
But before his second term, and he, going back, he always invites everyone to come to the governor's mansion at Christmas time for music and punch and cookies and stuff and pictures. So one Christmas, I took your book, Rebooting the American Dream, and I gave it to Governor O'Malley, and I said, please read this book and please run for president.
Wow.
And I think, I'm serious. So I think he read it. I hope he read it. It sounds like he read it. And then his second term as governor was awesomely progressive. I mean, I wish you would have him on his show. I think he would love to come.
Yeah.
And he has a great band, too, in there when he does music, too. He's like the coolest governor ever.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know, we'll ask Sean to give his office a call and see if we can get him on. That would be interesting. Yeah, that book, I mean, it's 11 policy prescriptions to put America back on track. And that book, Bernie Sanders was so impressed by that he actually wrote a personal letter to the other 99 senators in the U.S. Congress, and we delivered a copy of the book along with Bernie's letter to the offices of every single one of them. And Bernie basically said, you got to read this book. This is the prescription to put America back on track. So,
and it truly is.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hartman.
Well, thank you, Sydney. Yeah, a lot of work went into that book, Rebooting the American Dream. It's great to hear that story. Thank you. We will track that down. Margie in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Hey, Margie, what's up? You want to talk about the deadbeat dads? I got something wrong on that?
Yeah. Actually, where the push for going after child support and the deadbeat dads was from single women parents going to apply for benefits, welfare, and Medicaid.
Oh.
When they applied for the welfare and Medicaid, the state started demanding that they name the father in order to get the benefits, and then the states went after the fathers to recoup the money that they paid to the women, the mothers, for welfare benefits.
Right. That makes a lot of sense, particularly from a Republican point of view or in a Republican state. Excellent, Margie. And Shano pointed.
Can I give an update on the latest Scott Walker outrage?
Sure. Yes, please.
His newest plan now is for people that receive food stamp benefits, the EBT check cards, is that they will only, first of all, they'll need to have a photo ID to use the cards.
Right.
And they will only be able to use them at nonprofit food pantries.
Huh.
Think about the state of Wisconsin. It's very rural.
In other words,
a lot of places don't have food pantries.
Right, I was just going to say.
Also, apparently the homebound and people with disabilities, they can just starve to death because they're not able to go get their own food.
Scott Walker will make such a great president. He'll be just like Ronald Reagan. That's my big fear. Margie, thank you. Thank you for sharing with us. I appreciate the call. And apropos of the whole child support thing, too, I said that it had been criminalized. Shano corrected me and said that this is one of the big problems with child support, is that because it's a civil matter, not a criminal matter, you're not entitled to an attorney. You're not entitled to representation. And so poor people go into court on child support issues, and they don't have a lawyer, and they get screwed. And, you know, the system just comes down on them, and then you know, they get thrown in jail, and they got no lawyer to get them out, and they got no money to pay themselves out, and et cetera, et cetera. So, anyway, it's complicated, but in a way it's not. Brian in Schaumburg, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Brian, what's up?
I want to comment more about the root of the problem, and, of course, that is most Americans don't pay attention to politics. And, you know, the solution in my mind, or at least a way to find a solution, is we need to stress that the average American must develop a relationship with their representative. You know, the U.S. House of Representatives, your representative, mine is Tammy Duckworth. You need to know your representative for the state you live in that represents you. And we need to get people to take control of their representatives. That's possible because, like Tammy Duckworth, I think she won by merely like 35,000 votes. If you can organize a couple thousand people, believe me, you'll have the attention of your representative in Congress. And that's the only way you're going to change Washington. And that's the only way to fight big money, because big money is all about buying advertising to convince people on who to vote for or who not to vote for.
Well, and this is...
And,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
And I, just one more point, I wish media people, including you, would spend more time emphasizing that fact to people. You have to pay attention to your congressman.
Yeah.
You know, Obama is not the king. You cannot sit there and blame everything on what Obama does or not does, what Reagan did or did not do. Congress is a co-equal branch of government, and you must control Congress, which means you must pay attention to your Congress.
Yeah, I got it. And this is why Bernie says, if you want to have some say, don't just call the office of your congressman. Go to your local school or library and rent a hall, rent a room, and you can get them for free in a lot of public places. And get 100 or more of your friends together, or acquaintances, or neighborhood, or whatever, neighbors, to commit to coming, and then contact your member of Congress and say, we're putting on a town hall for you. We would like you to come and speak to us, and publicize it, and, you know, get active in things like that. Brian, excellent point. Thank you. Liz in West Hollywood, California. You wanted to talk about child support, Liz?
Oh, yes. I got off the speakerphone. I'm sorry. The whole thing is misogynist. These men, I worked in the child support court, so I have personal knowledge. And I've seen men, come from other countries, have a family, in the other country, have a family here, and then go around and knock up a whole bunch of other women, three, four other women, that he can't, and then he can't pay for any of them. I mean, because he's so minimum wage.
So are you suggesting mandatory vasectomies?
Yes, I think that would be an excellent idea. A lot of men I have heard, I don't want to use that because it doesn't feel good. I'm talking about condoms.
Mm.
Well, it feels a lot less good to take child support for a child you don't want for the next 18 years, let me tell you.
Yeah, I got a vasectomy after our third child was born. It was a good decision. I would encourage men to consider that. Whether we could mandate it by law for, quote, deadbeat dads, I doubt it. But I understand the sentiment, and I don't disagree with it. Liz, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls and talk radio news coming up. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Denise in Calumet, Michigan, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Denise, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was watching Rachel Maddow the other night, and I just was outraged when I found out for the first time that the Republicans have this other idea now to privatize the VA system.
Yeah.
I mean, do they hold nothing sacred?
No, they don't. They think that government is anything that is being run for the public good is an opportunity for one of their buddies to make money on it. Pardon my interrupting you, but that's the Republican. Back to you, Denise.
Well, it's bad enough they're trying to wipe out Social Security, but these soldiers or these military people, they're not part of the 1%.
No, and that's why the Republicans are going after them. The Republicans only exist to serve the 1%.
But the Republicans are the warmongers, and they're the ones that are sending these guys to war every chance they have.
That's right, but they don't care about the guys that they're sending to war. They care about the defense contractors who are making a fortune sending those guys to war and arming those guys, and the private, the private contractors, the Blackwaters of the world, where they can charge $200,000-$300,000 a year for each person, and then pay them $100,000 a year, and make a good profit on it. That's the Republican concern.
Maybe we'll get more Democratic votes from the military now.
I think it's entirely possible. I suspect that what's going on right now is massive overreach on the part of Republicans in Congress and all across the country. And it's going to cause, I think, a Harry Truman moment. It's going to cause one of those moments where everybody in America goes, really? The Scooby-Doo. So we'll see where it goes. But Denise, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. Ron in Yoder. There you go. Ron in Yoder, Indiana, Uh-oh, my call screen software seems to have locked up. Denise, are you still there? Denise is gone. And Ron's not there. So, anyhow, I'm gonna quit out of this. And, in fact, I got an error message when I quit. And we'll see what happens with that. I think we're going to have to revert back to our Telos system. Yeah. So anyhow, that was my point. I think the point is well made that the Republican Party is and has been for about 100 years a wholly owned subsidiary. Well, really, it goes back to the 1870s. There was a little period of time there from 1901 until maybe 1912 when the Republican Party was actually progressive. Or some people, there were progressives within the Republican Party, and one of them became president, Teddy Roosevelt. But other than that, and Dwight Eisenhower governed as a centrist. But other than that, the Republican Party has been the party of, by, and for the top 1%, for the rich, for them and for nobody else. And that's pretty grim. I don't know how to describe it other than that. That's just pretty damn grim. So what do we do about this? We have to wake people up to it. This is the big challenge. I think if everybody watching right now was to ask over the course of the next 6 months, just 10 people, please tell me anything that the Republican Party has done for average working people. Here's my list of what they've done for the Democrats have done for average working people. Basically, everything we've got. And the Republicans opposed all of it. It might wake up enough people that we could actually see change in this country. We'll be back. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service. Talk Radio News brought to you by the story of Sholene and Kier, the slave from South Sudan, that you can watch over at thanklist.com/watch. And Luke Vargas is with us from the Talk Radio News Service. Luke, you're live at the United Nations in New York today? Luke?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you just fine.
Oh terrific. I wanted to jump in on Yemen, an issue that seems to have been sort of making waves with the American public with the news yesterday that two more naval vessels are heading to the Gulf of Aden. They'll be joining 9 others that are already there. So I think it's already a little premature to say this in and of itself is necessarily the beginning of a major shift by the U.S. Ostensibly, we've been hearing until just this morning that this was about piracy, that we just wanted to be there to project a little power and to prevent any attacks on that important sea lane, as if the fact that our presence, the presence of the Saudi Navy and that of the Egyptian Navy, was still not enough of a deterrent. Now we're hearing a little bit different, seeming to confirm from Washington that one of the reasons they're there is because of this Iranian naval group that is coming into the area, 7 to 9 vessels. We don't know what's aboard, though some have been speculating it could be weapons for the fight in Yemen. We don't, again, have any confirmation from the U.S. that this is exactly their purpose there, but many seem to be paying attention to this. And the other headline from Yemen, which I think is actually more important, and I am really shocked that 15 or 16 hours on, it's not being picked up by anyone, was an exclusive by the Huffington Post last night that suggested that back at the end of last year, as those Houthi rebels were pushing in towards the capital of Yemen, Sana'a, that the Iranians had actually told them to back off, don't take the capital. This was, you know, supported in the Huffington Post by 3 of their writers, promoted quite a lot by the organization, and then disappeared. I sort of wonder what the reason here is. I mean, if you take this at face value, and again, I don't have any ability to independently confirm this, but it would seem to undercut the major narrative that Saudi Arabia is pushing here, that the reason they're launching airstrikes, the reason they have moved so much military equipment to their southern border with Yemen is because this was all Iran instigating this in the first place. This narrative would really be undercut if Iran was actually trying to dissuade the Houthis from taking the capital. And it would also confirm what analysts have been telling me, which is that the Houthis are not a group that has this big overarching concern of spreading Shia Islam around the world.
they're really a political reformist group. They want changes within the country. They're, I guess, if this is to be believed, willing to disobey orders from other Shia powers like Iran. Again, proving their focus might be much more domestic than any of these much simpler.
Well, and they're indigenous people too. They live in northwest, if my recollection is correct, Yemen. And so they're just, you know, local residents talking about their own place and their own people.
Absolutely. So we'll see if this comes up, if the U.S. government will make some mention of this report. I mean, we'd heard from the State Department spokesperson yesterday more and more talk about how Iran has been involved for years with supporting the Houthis. But if this report is to be believed, things might be a little bit more complicated than that simple proxy war narrative that we've been fed the past few months.
Absolutely. What else is up?
Moving along, I think it's, you know, it would be impossible for me to ignore the migrant issue in the Mediterranean. This is an issue that seems to be moving a little bit towards the United Nations at this point. The UN actually this morning gave the first independent death toll from the capsized boat on Sunday, putting it at over 800.
Luke?
Yes, hello.
Oh, yeah. Keep going.
I guess I dropped off. We're hearing now that the Italians are going to try to use the United Nations Security Council to try and push the creation of a UN force that would do something a little bit different here. You know, all the talk is about expanding search and rescue. Their resolution would try to create a UN force to go after the human traffickers in Libya. Very different approach. Unfortunately, it's going to be met with a whole bunch of difficulties, including the fact that a political solution in Libya would be needed first, and that appears to not be close at hand, but it is one solution that's being talked about. And the other is something we've heard from the German foreign minister in the past and others in Europe saying we should build something along the lines of refugee camps in northern Europe to try and give these migrants from all over Africa and various parts of Asia another option. Instead of pursuing this very dangerous water crossing, they could stay in these facilities. But I've talked to a number of human rights experts who are very frustrated with even the insinuation by Germany that this would be legitimate. You know,
isn't it reasonable to say, to assert, that one of the big problems that's going on right now with this refugee crisis that is hitting the in particular the southern Mediterranean countries really badly, is that the profit motive has gotten into this, that you've got people in Libya in particular who are rounding up boats and having refugees who are literally fleeing for their lives pay them. And it's, you know, it's become a money operation rather than just a refugee operation.
It's definitely something we've seen, and especially in a number of reports that these captains have been abandoning their vessels somewhat close to the coast and sort of in one sort of well-reported example a few months ago, a boat was basically steered towards Italy. The captain then sort of secured the instruments in the cockpit so that it would just go full steam ahead towards the coast, bailed and was picked up and returned, likely to pilot another boat. So that profit motive is definitely a huge thing fueling the movement of these people. And again, they're from all over the world. We've seen that 350 Eritreans were on this boat. So this is a country named today as the most censored country on earth, but one that doesn't get much play. You know, Syrians are talked about in this context, Somalians, Ethiopians, people from West Africa, but we had people from as far away as Bangladesh on this boat in the Mediterranean. So you mix all these countries people are fleeing from with that profit motive, and you can see why we had 220,000 people attempt this crossing last year.
Amazing. Amazing. What else is up?
I'll say very briefly, we had good news from the Energy Department yesterday showing that U.S. GDP growth was up last year. We knew that. It was about 2.4%. That's up from 2.2% the year before. But we saw basically a decoupling of increased economic growth and emissions growth. We only had a 0.7% increase last year in carbon dioxide emissions.
Well, that's good news.
Long-awaited decoupling.
So, that's good news.
Just a single headline, but it is something that many people have been hoping we would achieve here in the U.S. for quite a long time.
Thank you, Luke.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: Identity Guard, Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Yesterday was the anniversary, the fifth-year anniversary, I believe, of the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And shall we say some of the actors have not been behaving all that well. Actually, let me refer you on this to Dar Jamail. I don't have Dar on the board. Oh, he's on Skype. Okay, great. Dar, welcome.
Hey, Tom. Good to be with you.
Great to have you with us. Dar Jamail is an investigative journalist, staff writer with Truthout, truthout.org. And you wrote this brilliant piece, Gulf Victims Suing BP Disasters Compensation Czar. They're not going after, or I believe, from reading your piece, it looks like they're going after BP as well. But in addition, they're going after Ken Feinberg. Tell us the story. Give us the backstory here.
Ken Feinberg was brought in the immediate aftermath of the beginning of this disaster, literally just less than 3 months after the well exploded and sank and started this whole thing in motion. He was brought in, basically the man agreed upon between the federal government and BP to head the Gulf Coast Claims Facility, the GCCF, which was the body set up that people could go to who had suffered loss, you know, business losses, personal losses, et cetera, and filed claims to get compensation back from BP. We all remember the famous saying, BP is going to make you whole. Well, for starters, what they did is they came in and, you know, people were in severe economic distress. Fisheries were closed down. People literally weren't making ends meet right in the immediate aftermath of the disaster occurring. And so they were given some options. One was you can wait and play the long game and try to come in and sue BP later and get some compensation that way. Or you can sign this document we have for you here that will give you $5,000 immediately as long as you promise never to sue BP in the future. So $5,000 for individuals and $25,000 for businesses. Well over half of the people who were trying to get compensation signed those because they were that desperate for some kind of money to pay their bills immediately. And then the rest had basically been left languishing, trying to get enough money from the oil giant to try to, you know, basically rebuild their lives in the aftermath of this disaster. So this is all thanks to Ken Feinberg. And so
he was, if I may interrupt, Ken Feinberg was the guy who administered the 9/11 victims' claims, wasn't he?
Exactly. He's acquired the moniker the Master of Disaster because he's brought in the wake of corporate fiascos like GM manufacturing defects where there's going to be a lot of lawsuits, or the 9/11 disaster or terrorist attack, and in this case the BP disaster. He's basically brought in to act as a very effective defense attorney for the company that brings him in. And we have to bear in mind that BP paid him $1,250,000 a month for nearly 2 years to run the GCCF. So he was paid $25 million by BP to try to theoretically, from his perspective, be an independent representer, trying to help people get as much compensation as they could from BP. So if you just look at who's paying for him, I think that's about as far as you need to look in this instance.
Yeah, somebody pays me $25 million, I'd probably jump through a few hoops for them. Not speaking of Ken Feinberg's ethics or morality, but he's clearly a good representative for the company. So how are people responding to this?
Well, the article I wrote is about three different people, and there's actually more than that, but three different lawsuits going through one firm, Brian Donovan Law Group out of Florida, who are, as individuals, suing Ken Feinberg's firm because they believe he grossly misrepresented himself. He made several public statements and things in writing that they're taking him to task over, basically promises that he never kept and never intended to keep. And just to give you a little more perspective on this, and you might remember this, Tom, in 2011, Judge Carl Barbier in New Orleans, who basically the federal judge that's overseeing the major lawsuit against BP in the three different parts of that lawsuit in the wake of the disaster, he actually, Feinberg was so out of line and misrepresenting himself, trying to make it look as though he were actually an independent person that had the best interests of the spill victims in mind. Judge Barbier came out in 2011 and actually passed a ruling instructing Feinberg, you can no longer claim you're independent and you can no longer claim you're acting in the best interest of these people who are trying to get compensation. That's how out of line he
was. Wow. So you're officially a shill for BP.
Yeah, that was the message.
Yeah, amazing. Well, he must be a Republican. Anyhow, so where is this going to go? We're talking with Dara Jamil, investigative reporter with truthout.org. Where is this going to go?
Well, it's going to take time. Obviously, these big lawsuits do. I mean, we still, you know, BP's playing the long game. I actually received an email yesterday from someone, a victim of the Exxon Valdez disaster in 26 years ago. And him saying, look, yeah, BP's doing the same thing. That oil spill destroyed my business and I'm still, you know, trying to get by today. More than half the people who had lawsuits against Exxon for that disaster have died. So that's the oil company's strategy, is to play the long game. So we can expect this to keep being drawn out. BP's, of course, to them, it's just an exercise in trying to minimize their liability over time. And so far, given how much destruction they've caused and continue to cause across the Gulf Coast, they've been doing a pretty good job of minimizing their liability.
That's astonishing. And a corporation can live forever, and a human can't. So they just wait them out, let them die.
That's the strategy. That's exactly what we're seeing.
That's incredible. What is the state of the Gulf right now?
Well, this story just focused on one aspect of it, but another Truthout reporter, Mike Ludwig, has another story on the website right now focusing on the fisheries. He went out with some of the Vietnamese fishermen out of Mississippi, and they're basically saying, look, our catches immediately plummeted in the aftermath of the spill and have never come back anywhere near what they were before the spill. So the fishing industry is suffering. We're continuing to have record number die-offs of dolphins and other marine mammals, and other worrying signs that show that there's ecological devastation that's going to go on for many years. And a lot of the wildlife biologists that I've spoken with down there have told me exactly the same thing, that, you know, we're not talking about even single digit years of recovery here. We're talking about decades, because if you look at, for example, the Ekstok oil platform disaster in 1979 in the Bay of Campeche on the other side of the Gulf of Mexico, that part of the Gulf of Mexico still hasn't recovered from that. So that gives people a little bit of perspective of how much time we're talking about,
wow,
and particularly considering how much larger the BP spill was than that one.
Yeah, that was like 35 years ago or more.
Right.
That's amazing.
That's right.
That's amazing. Yeah. So is BP trying to claim that everything's fine now, we've taken care of this? I've seen the ads that they're running on all the TV networks, presumably so they can hand the TV networks millions of dollars, and the TV networks won't do any investigative reporting about them. But maybe not. Maybe their intentions are just to say, hey, look at how wonderful we are. They're basically, in the minute we have left, they're basically saying, everything's cool.
That's exactly what they're doing, and that's exactly how they're doing it. You just lined it out. When you run these multi-million dollar advertising campaigns and just start shelling out the money to the networks, putting your propaganda out there, everything's fine, go back to work, eat the fish, everything's good. That's exactly what they're doing, and the reality is basically the opposite. This is an ongoing disaster that continues to impact millions of people across the Gulf Coast.
Right. Balancing the need of people in the Gulf and the fishermen to make a living and the need of the rest of us not to die of cancer, is the food coming out of the Gulf Coast yet safe?
From what I've seen talking with what fishermen continue to find out there in their nets and on the ends of their lines, as well as the research I've done for stories I've written about seafood deformities and how deep into the food chain this disaster has gone, I think it's safe to say that the seafood is not safe to eat out of the Gulf of Mexico, nor will it be anytime soon.
Wow, amazing stuff. Dar Jamil, you're a bright light in the world of journalism, and so I'm so pleased and honored to have you on the program today. Thank you.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Keep up the great work. Dar Jamil, his piece over at truthout.org, Gulf Victims Suing BP.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with your calls and my thoughts and the news of the day right after this. Stick around. And welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And Jim in Rockport, Illinois. Hey, Jim, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. How are you today?
I am well. What's up?
Well, actually, there's two parts to my call today. Is first off, you had talked on your earlier segment about asking the Republicans or asking people what the Republican Party has done for you.
Right.
When I get into a debate with a Republican, that's my first line of attack. Is other than Medicare Part D, how has the Republican Party made your life easier?
Mm-hmm.
And I have never gotten an answer. I've gotten more questions, but never answers.
Right.
So it
same here.
The big thing is the Gulf of Mexico. It seems like your show and Ed Schultz are the only ones that bring this to light.
Mm-hmm.
And he's actually running a series right now. And the most appalling thing are those commercials that they run saying how they're surprised at how fast the Gulf has recovered.
Right.
The Gulf has not recovered, and it may never recover. That toxic that plume that they put in there is just devastating.
Yeah.
And you're seeing it in your oysters and your shrimping. And they've lost 70% of their fishing industry down there. How do they get by? It's just appalling.
Yeah, it's people losing their homes, losing their families, losing their businesses. It's and BP's response is, hey, you got a business that you've just lost? You want $25,000? Here, sign this release. Or, hey, you just lost your job for the next 5 years? Here, we'll give you $5,000. Sign this release and go away. I mean, it's mind-boggling.
Well, it's terrible. And like I said, I've called the White House. It's something that we should keep their feet to the fire on, Tom. There's no way they should renege on it. As a matter of fact, when they have these settlements, and I believe they settled for $20 billion on their claims, they should be held to a time limit. They should not sit there playing this game of let's wait and see how many die before we settle our claims. It's just appalling. They made a mistake, and they should pay the price for it. And unfortunately, it's the people in the Gulf. And why they vote Republican down there, because they're in bed with the oil companies, as we all know. I mean, Jesus, they're so beholden to them. They'll never take action on
They've,
it either.
They're voting Republican down there because the Republican shills, the politicians and the paid spokespeople and the think tanks and the advertising machine are very, very good at what they do. They're bringing in the suckers.
But they're not working for the people. And Bobby Jindal is one of them.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a sad thing to see, Tom. But the most important thing is keep a light on this subject. We've got to hold BP's feet to the fire at all costs. And maybe there should be some environmental outfit that goes out there and runs a counter commercial if they can. Now, to me, that would be a big plus.
Yeah, I agree. Like Greenpeace or somebody like that, or the Gulf is not clean yet. It's just, you know, my only reluctance about going there is that they are fishing in the Gulf right now. And if Americans got skitsy about Gulf food, then those people would lose their jobs. And so part of me is like, I don't want to do anything that would diminish demand for food out of the Gulf. On the other hand, if that food is poisonous, you know, shouldn't we be figuring out, shouldn't the government or BP be paying these families so that, and these businesses, and, you know, let us get our fish someplace else for a while. Although right now, getting our fish, if you get it out of the Pacific Ocean, you got a problem too. Thanks a lot for the call, Jim. If you're going to get out of the Pacific, you got a problem too. It's filled with Fukushima radiation. You know, fish coming out of the Pacific is full of cesium and strontium and whatnot. Coming out of the Gulf, it's full of poison. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Paul, what's up?
How you doing?
Good.
You know, Neil's one of my favorite guests on the show. that he always seems to just step in it in terms of, you know, he argued that, oh, I bet the guy who's the Tea Partier who now thinks that maybe the Democratic Party's done more for him, he said, I bet he liked it when Reagan raised his military pay 25%. Well, he just identified, I guess that was part of that raising the military was part of tripling the national debt because he didn't raise taxes to do that.
Right.
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 So, in other words, that jobs program was just a giveaway.
Yeah.
Now, you compare that to the Democratic programs. Nobody ever paid, other than paying into Social Security, it didn't cost anybody else any money.
Right.
How about Medicare? The same thing. All of the programs that the Democrats have set up have been self-sustaining. The Social Security hasn't added to the national debt. The Social Security Trust Fund is a creditor of the national debt.
Right.
Well, I mean, this is, it's funny. And when these people like me argue for this freedom from government and the things they don't like a minimum wage, and this is when they're arguing for a time, I think like you were pointing out, 125 years ago, or actually 100 years ago to just after the Civil War and up until the New Deal, was the poorest time in America's history.
Yeah.
Most people were destitute.
Yep.
That's what they're arguing. When they argue freedom from government, that's what they're arguing. In other words, freedom from us organizing to help ourselves.
Freedom to
that's
live in
arguing.
Destitution.
And then just let the robber barons take over and do it.
Yeah, freedom to live in destitution. Freedom to, you know, back to the old, couple of years ago when the Republican primary was going on and Wolf Blitzer asked that question of Ron Paul, and the answer from somebody in the audience was let him die, you know.
Let him die.
Freedom to die like a dog in the gutter. That's Republicans' idea of freedom for working people. But their idea of freedom for millionaires and billionaires is quite different. I mean, Republicans just passed out of the House of Representatives, and now John Thune is leading the charge for it in the Senate, Republican John Thune, to cut inheritance taxes altogether on the wealthiest 0.02% of Americans, about 1,000 families, 2,000 families
right,
at the most.
So that we can establish a true aristocracy, and so we really will have conservatism, and that the classical conservatism where we have the Romanovs and the Bourbons and the Habsburgs.
Right.
That's the kind of conservative.
Well, that's what you have right now. I mean, the Romanovs were supporting political. Well, actually, they were political themselves. But how are the Koch brothers or Shelley Adelson or any of these other major players different from those kind of groups?
They're not. That's exactly when you read War and Peace, for instance, that's all about the five aristocratic families who, you know, had big influence on the monarchy.
I confess I've never read War and Peace. I was intimidated by its size.
Well, you got to keep living, so you just keep going. So,
yeah.
They talk about the founding fathers. They didn't find freedom from government. They founded a government. They founded the most comprehensive government in the history of the world. So, To say that the founding fathers wanted freedom from government, I think is absolutely silly.
Yeah.
And the programs that we have founded, the democratic policies and programs that people most people don't want to get rid of. Oh, and by the way, I was trying to think what was on the tip of my tongue here. I have to point out, and I've said it on this program, and I said it in my Social Security talk that I held a couple of weeks ago. All four of the cuts to Social Security that I said they wanted to do have now been articulated by Chris Christie and now Jeb Bush, which is cut benefits. Of course, the chain CPI was already in there, raising the retirement age, and means testing. All four of those have now been articulated, so I can say, everybody, I was right. That's exactly what they have in mind. And why do they want to do that, Tom? We know why cut. What the reason why they want to cut benefits is because why draw down on that big fat Social Security trust fund? You don't want to get rid of that.
Well, not only no. Wait, hang on just a second here, Paul. I think that they want to cut benefits because when they privatize Social Security, right now Social Security has enough money to pay all those benefits. But once
right.
they privatize it, once Jamie Dimon at JPMorgan Chase owns and runs Social Security. We got to, right. You know, they got to skim his salary off the top. They got to skim all the other guys who make millions of dollars a year off the top. They got to skim the advertising costs. They've got to skim off, you know, the dividends to give to their stockholders. And so the only way that they can make that money, that pile of money, last long enough and be large enough to make that happen is to reduce the amount of payments that they're giving to people on Social Security.
Right. You articulated exactly what I was trying to say. Exactly correct. And everybody, please, when you talk about privatization, think about how would privatizing it bring in more money?
Right.
Well, there's only one way to speculate that could happen, and that is speculation. And what I mean by that is playing fast and loose with it as unsecured derivatives, and then your whole fund. And you think even if they make profits and they make money on it, it's going to trickle down to you?
No.
You think you're going to get – and that's the way they'll sell it is, you know, potentially you could get an even higher Social Security payment than – and here's the other thing. If they invested in the stock market like that, if they invested in securities like that rather than treasury bonds, what happens to a market that's constantly being sold off because 20% of it has to be sold off to pay benefits? Isn't that a declining market?
Yeah, that's at the very least, it's a very unstable market. I mean, putting Social Security's money in the stock market, you know, especially a couple of trillion dollars, is nuts. Yeah,
it's completely insane.
It would be such a deforming event. I mean, in terms of how it would modify the stock market, and it would put all that money at risk. But you know, hey, you know, if the Republicans can pull this off, if they can hand off to Jamie Dimon and his buddies the Social Security Trust Fund and the Social Security Program, those guys are going to make billions, and they will then skim money off the top of the money that they make and give it back to the Republican politicians in the form of campaign contributions and super PAC funding. So, I mean, they've got this thing down, Paul, and you know it as well as I do. They've got this down. It's a scam. Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
28 minutes past the hour. Back with more of your calls, my thoughts, and the news of the day right after this. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you 28 minutes before the hour. Some interesting stuff bubbling up. Listen to this comment. Let's finally do something about the growing inequality that is tearing our country apart. This is a politician who said this. The top 1% of our households hold 22% of our nation's wealth. Enough with corporate welfare, enough with golden parachutes, and enough with the tax incentives for companies to shift jobs overseas. Who said that and when? Well, it was Hillary Clinton who said it, but she said it in 2007. When she was running for president and she was a senator. That was her platform. She wanted to do away with the carried interest loophole. She wanted to roll back the Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthy. She wanted to limit, put tighter regulations on derivatives, and limit chief executive CEO compensation. That was the basis of her 2007 campaign. Anyway, just FYI. Audrey. In Chicago. Hey, Audrey, you wanted to get back to the child support issue?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes, I can. I was calling because I do agree with you that it appears that they're using the issue of child support to criminalize people because there are deadbeat moms out there. It appears that they're trying to criminalize primarily African-Americans and really the poor and the working class. My thing is, it is important. I think I've told you before, I'm a single mom. My son is grown now. But those child support payments were necessary for our survival. The thing is, it wouldn't have done any good for my ex-husband to have been arrested when he tried to get out of paying them. How would he have been able to maintain employment?
Correct.
How would he have been able to pay it? And so what they did here in Illinois, even though he's in another state, they wrote up court orders and sent them to his employers.
Right, they garnished his wages.
To have them. Yeah, basically, yeah. And he had to pay a fee to those employers. For them to do that is a whole lot more productive means if they really truly cared
about ensuring that parents pay child support who weren't doing it on their own. That's a much more productive means.
I completely agree. And, in fact, Walter Scott, the guy who ran away and got shot by the cop because he ran away after the traffic arrest, he had a really good job, and he was paying his child support, and somehow he got behind, and they threw him in jail for 2 weeks, and he lost a good job and never got back on his feet, never recovered from it. And his child support went to $8,000, and then to, it was at $18,000 that he owed at the time of that traffic stop. That's just not right. I mean, you know,
And what made it even more ridiculous, that particular tragedy, I've had many jobs in order to survive, and one of them, believe it or not, was a cop. I was a Forest Preserve District cop. Hmm. They had all kinds of ways to find that man. He had his driver's license. Hello. Just visit him at home and arrest him there if that's what they do.
Right.
They had the car there. There was a woman there in the car, or at least a passenger. I'm not sure who's male or female.
Yeah.
But they had all kinds of ways to find this man without running him down, first of all. And then, of course, the ultimate was gunning him down. That was just atrocious.
Yeah. Yeah. I absolutely agree. It was horrific. Audrey, thank you for the call. Thank you for your comments. Randy in Onawa, Iowa. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. The common thread through the whole day show is privatization or is antitrust. And this privatization and deregulation of the conservatives gives us, the taxpayer, an obligation to pay taxes directly to corporations.
Essentially.
When you add corporate inversion, we could be in the near future or currently now paying taxes or having a foreign corporation collect taxes on American citizens. And I think this is a serious issue that you cannot have a business relationship at any level that does not have an element for antitrust.
Right.
So.
Yeah. I agree. And the Republicans now are talking about, let's privatize the IRS. Can you imagine one of these bill collecting companies being the ones who are advising you on your tax matter? I mean, it's nuts. It is nuts. The profit motive does not solve all ills, and rich people are not going to save America. It's just that simple. Thank you, Randy, for the call. Jerry in Spring Lake, North Carolina. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind?
Hello, Tom. I get these people that say they represent the pro-life movement, and when they start talking about me trying to get my opinions on things, I ask them a simple question. Can you tell me why, if they're so interested in a child before it's born, why it is that none of them care about the child once it's born? They just throw them out on a heap of crap and say survive or die or be indentured. That's their whole philosophy.
Well, it's because most of them, I believe, I mean, I haven't seen statistics on this, but most of the, you know, really, really, really deeply hardcore, very committed and convicted forced pregnancy folks are doing it out of religion. You know, their religion, the Catholic Church and many of the Protestant evangelical branches have taken the position that abortion at any point in time, for pretty much any reason, is murder and therefore is wrong. It's an absolute sin. And so I think that what they would say, Jerry, in their defense, is that, you know, they're trying to prevent murder, not abuse. So if a child grows up being abused or having bad circumstances, well, you know, that's life. But at least we kept him from being murdered.
I don't see it, but Jesus never said that in any of his sermons.
I know. That's the point. It's like trying to argue religion is a damn difficult thing. Jerry, thank you for the call. I get it. Bill in El Dorado Hills, California. Excuse me. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind? Thanks for listening to Sirius.
I wanted to talk about child support. I had custody.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter, because of the fights and everything of trying to get custody and child support that my ex-wife owed me, and I don't care. You know, I didn't need it. But the problem was is that it destroyed the relationship that she had with her mother. And I always wonder what happens with the father if, you know, with their child.
You mean your daughter has been alienated from her mom because her mom is not making child support payments to you?
No, what happened is that we fought over it. She moved to Santa Barbara. Her parents basically said, well, she's not making any money anymore because they supported her.
Right.
They could afford it. You know, they had a home in Santa Barbara, Tahoe, and Scotland.
Wow.
So they could afford all that. And so, like, well, she's not making any more money, so she can't afford it. They paid for an attorney up here where I live and said, well, she doesn't make any money anymore. And my daughter, I never said anything, but she found out through her godparents, and it destroyed it. You know,
yeah.
The whole thing destroyed it.
Sorry to hear that. I would think you should care, Bill. I would think that probably one of the top priorities in your life right now should be reconciling your daughter with your ex-wife.
Yeah, I think my daughter should do that.
Forgive me for sounding like Ann Landers, but, you know, having, you know, family is something that, you know, in the last days of our lives, typically that's the thing that we regret the most is that we didn't spend enough time with our families.
Yeah, I agree with that. I was saying with the funds.
Yeah.
Now I think my daughter should have reconciled with her mother. Her godmother helps, and so she doesn't.
Good.
You know.
So your point, the point of your call basically was that child support can be another irritant or another problematic issue in a divorce. That hurts the child.
Yeah, and that's what I think is
okay.
A lot of
the flip side of that. The flip side of that is what happens to a single parent who has custody but doesn't have a means of support or doesn't have a means of support that would be appropriate to raise a child on. And for that, it seems absolutely and utterly vital that child support be available, or that we strengthen our social safety net so that it's more like that of Northern Europe.
I agree with you with Northern Europe. You
yeah.
live in Germany, I live in Paris,
mm-hmm.
and over there, they're taken care of.
Yeah.
And that's what I would rather have than what we have here.
Yeah, in a way you could argue that the whole child support argument is simply an extension of Republican logic that each individual is responsible for themselves and their family, period, full stop. Society is not responsible for anything. And if you're not rich, if you weren't, you know, born from a father who had made millions with Joe Stalin building an oil company like Koch Industries, then, you know, tough luck, screw you, go die in the gutter. I mean, that's basically the conservative mindset. So of course they would say, you know, if there's a divorce, then, you know, whichever spouse has more money needs to pay it. In many cases, neither spouse has any money. And then what do we do? I mean, you know, this the ability to pay is... Anyhow, Bill, thank you for the call. And good on you. I wish you the very best on reconciling your daughter and your ex-wife. It's got to be a tough one. It's got to be a real tough one. This is an area, too, I confess, I don't know much about at all. I've never been divorced. I've never had to pay child support. So I don't have any personal knowledge of it. But... it's a fascinating topic. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls, the news of the day, and my thoughts on it right after this. And welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And... let's see here. Robin in Kingston, Washington. Hey, Robin.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am well. You think the VA should be ended?
A voice of opposition to an issue that everybody's getting hysterical about, quotes, privatizing the VA. I have an alternative point of view because I'm a progressive and I'm still an anti-war person. Instead of privatizing the VA, I really think that we deserve, and for the anti-war movement, to if we brought the war home to our local hospitals and our local communities, that we would have a more effective tool with which to say, let's not do this again. So my feeling is that we should look into changing the VA. Actually, if I had my choice, I would eliminate it and roll it all into Medicare and take the funds that the Pentagon gives to the VA, which are not in the, which is not in the Pentagon budget, okay, and just roll them right into Medicare and spread all of the people out and take a look at it from a very different point of view.
I understand your logic, Robin, and I know and you want to roll it into Medicare. That's fine. It's a single payer program. I mean, it's not fine. I'm going to argue against it, but it here's the problem. You know, with people who have very rare diseases have this orphan drug problem. The drug companies will not develop pharmaceuticals for rare diseases because they're not profitable. You know, drug companies now, right now, they're all trying to figure out how to cure Hep C because millions and millions of Americans have Hep C, and that's the big money drug. But nobody is trying to cure, you know, Johnson-Barr whistling syndrome or what. You know, I mean, you pick up these weird, bizarre diseases that only have 200-300 people, you know, or 1,000 people around the country. Here, the reason I mention that is because hospitals, veterans have very unique health care needs, particularly combat veterans. People who have been in combat are confronting issues, both physical and psychological, that the average patient on Medicare does not confront. And so they have highly specialized equipment at VA hospitals and specifically trained people to work with this particular population. And if you simply said to all these folks, just go to your local hospital that accepts Medicare, odds are that they would not have access to the advanced prosthetics, to the physical therapy, to the psychological therapy, to all the things that the VA does actually quite well. And that's why.
Well, Tom, I'm gonna just stand my ground here and say, then let's get the special equipment to the local or regional hospitals and do that. And then what we're going to come back with, again, it's kind of a single-payer program eventually for everything, and we're going to be able to let the taxpayers know and let the high school kids know that here is the VA ward or here are some of the veterans here. So I think it's worthy of an entire upgrade, and I think it's part of the true costs of war,
yeah,
which are now pretty much being hidden, and these vets are being hidden away. I'm in the streets with my peace signs all the time, and they come up to me. I know how broken they are, Tom. They talk to me.
Yeah.
And I just think we need to rethink this.
It's an interesting point, Robin, and you may be right. You may well be right. I don't pretend expertise on this. What I would love to find out is how other countries do it, how other advanced countries do it. And although most of them have not had all the combat fatalities and injuries that we have had. Robin, thank you for the call. We'll be back. Yeah. 10 minutes before the hour, talk media for the sane among us. Tom Hartman here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Bill in Alton, Illinois. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind today?
Hey, what's on my mind is let's put in a plug for stopping Fast Track again. I know people are maybe starting to catch on.
Yes.
But, hopefully they're not getting tired of hearing about this.
Please, please call. Actually, I had a conservative on my TV program last night. Yeah, it must have been last night. Today is Tuesday. And we were like the conservative case against Fast Track and the liberal case against Fast Track. I was not debating him. We were agreeing. And he said that the only thing that will stop Fast Track right now, because enough Democrats have signed up for it, have gone along with the administration, the only thing that will stop it right now are Republicans in the House of Representatives. And he said that they know that they've got 40 Republicans who oppose it, but they need 80 Republicans to actually stop it. And
right.
So if you so the most important phone calls that can be made right now, if the people listening to this conversation, Bill, is if you live in the district of a Republican member of the House of Representatives, if your congressman or woman is a Republican, call them now. You don't, and you may not want to tell them that you're a Democrat or a progressive. Simply call them and say, you are my representative. I am opposed to Fast Track and to TPP SHAFTA, and in particular Fast Track. It is unconstitutional. It's an unconstitutional abrogation of the power of Congress, And then, you know, TPP is, we're handing a whole bunch of powers, constitutional powers, over to foreign corporations. This is nuts. So it's really important that people right now call their Republican members of the House.
Well, strangely, though, like in my instance, okay, I can call both my senators, both my you know, okay, notoriously by reputation, progressive Senator Durbin here in Illinois,
right.
And I can call Kirk also because they're both really going to support it. I mean, Durbin will not, I've talked to his staffers, and he will not admit to a position on it. They plead ignorance. Well, we don't know. He's still making up his mind. But, of course, and this is the part that I find real interesting. People have forgotten who voted what on NAFTA, and we now blame that on Clinton. I mean, it was real interesting. Over the weekend, I was canvassing with a bunch of union people over in St. Louis, Missouri. And at a certain point, you know, I was meeting these people for the first time, and we were kind of schmoozing and talking with them and saying, hey, what do you guys think? Well, who gave us NAFTA? And what do you think they said? Clinton.
Right.
It's like, well, wait a minute. You know, now, didn't you guys have congressmen and senators that maybe had a part in that? Clinton signed it into law, but we couldn't have done this without Congress. And, of course, that was being fast-tracked at that time, too. And, I mean, if you look at the record, a lot of those people are still in Congress. And Dick Durbin at that time was a congressman. He's now a senator. And I fully expect my, like I said, highly progressive senator to go ahead and vote for fast track and to right. vote for
that's why I don't disagree with you. And I mean, you know, it's not a bad idea. It's a very good idea to call even a progressive senator, certainly a Democrat, and say, you know, hey, you know, I'm opposed to fast track and to TPP/SHAFTA. And to call your Republican as well. We all need to be making these phone calls right now. This is a big deal. And there's no magic bullet that's going to take this thing down. We really need to get it right. So anyhow, Bill, I got to move along, but thank you very much for the call and, appreciate it. Nora in Minneapolis. There you go. Hey, Nora, what's up? No? Okay, hang on just a minute. Let me just see what happened here. For some reason, line 10 just X'd out. Oh, the call screen. Yeah, okay. Nora, are you on the air? Nora's not listening to her.
There I am. Yeah,
there you are. Okay, great. So what's up?
Okay, well, not only did I have one disagreement with you after 10 years, but I forgot to tell her, I wanted to ask you a question about, I went to the White House app, and I clicked on to Secretary Perez, answer your questions about the trade agreement. And then it said it will include complete ability of, what do you call it, enforceability of environmental standards and enforceability of trade, what do you call it, wage standards, et cetera.
Right.
And I'm like, when they say enforceability, does that mean, well, we could, but they're not going to have money to actually enforce any of it? Or how does
it? I think what it means is that, you know, Vietnam has decided that their minimum wage is going to be 52 cents an hour. It used to be 35 cents an hour, something like that. Bernie gave the actual numbers last Friday. And under this new agreement, this is their minimum wage. And if any employers in Vietnam who are selling things through the agreement are paying less than that, then you can go after them. But it's still 52
oh, okay.
cents an hour.
So they're talking about different standards than what people would actually
It's smoke and mirrors, Nora. It's
okay,
bait
that's
and switch.
I wanted to explain. Okay, so my disagreement with you is one time you were saying that you thought it would have helped the war or helped drugs in the world or the war on drugs or something if they would have burnt some farmer's field of opium. And I have to say, I agree with Dr. Carl Hart, the author of High Price, that drugs are not ever the problem. There's something else that's causing a problem.
No, I agree with that, Nora. But in the first year of his administration, George W. Bush did something good. And that was he gave, as I recall, it was $20 million, might have been $40 million, a relatively small amount of money, to the government of Afghanistan to give to their opium farmers in exchange for destroying their crops. And they actually gave them more money than they would have made if they had sold the opium. And the result of that was that the worldwide supply of heroin crashed in 2001. The price of heroin exploded, and the number of new addicts and the number of new HIV infections, particularly in Europe and Russia, collapsed. And all good things. And since Bush's invasion of Afghanistan, they're back to growing massive amounts of opium poppies, supplying the heroin market around the world, and it's not a good thing. Nora, thank you for the call. We'll be back tomorrow. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get involved. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.